Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The day Shiite Muslims consider the holiest day of the year, Ashura, has instead turned into a bloody day for Shiite worshippers in both Iraq and Pakistan. More than 180 Iraqis and Pakistanis have died today as blasts ripped through mosques in Baghdad and Karbala in Iraq. And another blast occurred during a religious procession in Quetta, Pakistan. The holy day of Ashura commemorates the day when the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad was killed, resulting in what has become a major split between Sunni and Shiite Muslims. Joining me on the line from Karbala, Iraq, is Reuters reporter Luke Baker. Hi, Luke.
Hi.
Luke, tell me what you can about the bombings today in Iraq. What's the latest from where you are?
The bombs went off this morning about sort of 6 or 8 hours ago now, right when the festival of Ashura was reaching its peak here in Karbala. Perhaps 2 million people on the streets of the city, really very, very packed. And we had these 5 coordinated bomb blasts which just tore through packed crowds, left incredible destruction in their wake. Amazingly, the situation in Karbala has now really calmed down. People have gone back to the religious festival. They're concluding their rituals of Ashura, and they're really saying they were trying to draw more, even more faith in what the festival stands for, and the fact the sacrifice of Hussein 1,400 years ago, and the fact that so many of them have been sacrificed here in, or they say, been sacrificed here in Karbala today.
These were mortar attacks.
It's certainly not clear. It has been claimed and it's been said that they were mortar attacks, but I've just spoken to the chief investigator here in Karbala, who believes that there may also have been suicide bombers involved.
Who do people believe did this?
It obviously always depends on who you speak to. Immediately after the bombs were going off, there were people shouting, the Wahhabis did this, referring to the extremely devout Sunni sect from which Osama bin Laden comes. Others wanted to point the finger at the Americans or the Israelis. It's endless just theories do the rounds. But it's certainly clear that anyone who wanted to destabilize a sense of rising power of the Shia would have had a vested interest in carrying out this attack. And the Shia here know that, so they point the finger at Sunnis, maybe at al-Qaeda, but it really just, at this stage, is impossible to tell.
Has the name Abu Musab Zarqawi come up? U.S. forces in Iraq, as you know, have previously said they intercepted a computer disk from him. He's a Jordanian believed to have worked for al-Qaeda, continues to work for al-Qaeda with a $10 million bounty on his head.
Well, of course, yeah. And Zarqawi, as we've found out in these last weeks, apparently had written letters expressing that if they were going to try and incite civil war in this country, what needed to happen was the Shia needed to be attacked and to hit them where it would hurt as such. And to strike on Ashura, such a symbolic day, such a momentous day, particularly as this festival wasn't celebrated in public under Saddam. It was effectively banned. And that if it really was Zarqawi that wrote this letter, then it would seem as if that sort of game plan is being played out, unfortunately. And that is the sort of thing that will end up perhaps fomenting civil war. They hasten to add, at the same time, we've spoken to both Shia and some Sunni groups today who say that they may even be involved in a public display, some sort of march of solidarity between all Muslims, between Sunni and Shia in Iraq. It's not definite that's going to happen, but they are invested in showing that there is unity in this community in Iraq.
So they are not necessarily screaming for revenge right away. There's actually talk of solidarity between Iraqis, Shia and Sunni, who may want to present themselves as refusing to be pulled into a civil war?
Certainly from perhaps calmer minds higher up in administrations of Shiite politics and political organization are trying to get across this calmness, trying to get across this moderation, and are saying, yes, we need to be controlled here. We need to understand that we do not want to be drawn into this sticky web of potential civil war, and we do not want to be the ones who instigate, you know, who are dividing or splitting the sects even further. So I think they're trying to really sort of get across this message of moderation, and they hope that they can make sure that there isn't going to end up being what would be an inevitably very nasty civil war. I mean, perhaps it's a long way off, but I mean, it's certainly people fear that it's out there.
Reuters reporter Luke Baker speaking to us from Karbala, Iraq. Luke, thanks very much.
Thank you.
UN weapons inspectors are expected to release a report today saying that they now believe there have been no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq since 1994. The report seems to back up an earlier study by U.S. Inspector David Kaye. Joining us on the line is USA Today reporter Bill Nichols. And Bill, this new UN report is a required quarterly report. The UN Security Council is expected to outline it as early as Friday. But remind us, because they're all starting to blur, what's new and different in this report?
What's new and different about this is, as we say in the piece, it's the first outside study to essentially confirm what David Kaye said a few weeks ago, which is there is now no evidence that there were weapons of mass destruction, perhaps some traces, but no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq after 1994. So it's both a validation of what Kaye said and also a change of what the UN had said previously. The UN before the war, while not nearly as strong as the Bush administration was, did indicate that there were weapons that were unaccounted for. They still had concerns that there might be things lying around. But they now believe, based on looking back at their own records, the work that they did in Iraq just before the war, and looking at what Kaye has released publicly, that there was nothing in Iraq, and this is biological and chemical, after 1994.
Well, and how does this quarterly report differ from the last one? I guess the question is, if this is a routine report, why wasn't this finding in the last one?
Well, because they were close to this in the last one, but they're still getting more information, and they're being able to analyze what Kaye has found. I mean, after all, when the UN was there in the last 5 months before the war began, they didn't have nearly the access that U.S. inspectors have now. So they're gradually moving their findings up and their standards up as they have access to what Kaye is saying publicly. They don't have access to the classified portions of Kaye's report. And we have to also remember that the U.S. made a very firm decision not to let U.N. inspectors back into Iraq after the war was over, preferring to use their own people.
Well, just briefly, Bill, the acting executive chair of the U.N. inspections team speaks in your article as if this is also vindication of U.N. inspectors.
Yeah, you have to remember what the climate was before the war, which was there was no love lost between the U.N. and the U.S., their inspection team specifically. And the general feeling from the Bush administration was that these people weren't very good, they weren't nearly aggressive enough, they didn't really want to find anything, they were basically trying to avoid having a confrontation with Iraq. But if you look at the facts, as outlined by David Kaye, essentially nothing really has been found after the war that U.N. inspectors didn't find before the war. The major violation that's been found, there are other minor things, but the major violations that's been found was a missile program that exceeded the 93-mile U.N. limit that was put on Iraq. And U.N. inspectors found that before the war and basically destroyed all the missiles that were available. So Perikos, he's a very soft-spoken man and doesn't like to toot his own horn, but they're certainly very pleased that this image, as Colin Powell said, of Inspector Clouseau bumbling around Iraq just doesn't fit the facts that have emerged there.
You're referring to Demetrios Perikos, acting executive chair of the UN inspections team.
That's correct. He's Hans Blix's successor.
Yeah. Well, Bill, thank you.
My pleasure.
USA Today reporter Bill Nichols.
Across the country, thousands of soldiers are preparing to head out to Iraq in one of the largest U.S. military rotations ever. But many of them are not full-time soldiers. In fact, about half of them. They're weekend warriors, National Guard, and reservists. And there are questions if they are ready for the violent reality of fighting the war as it is now in Iraq. Guardian reporter Suzanne Goldenberg was recently at Fort Bliss, Texas, where she witnessed firsthand how the military trains reservists. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Suzanne, thanks for joining us. Tell us just in broad terms first what you saw.
Well, I was allowed to spend 2 days on the training ranges at Fort Bliss. I saw live fire exercises where soldiers fire at targets and then exercises where they move through the field, learning how to maneuver with their weapons as they walk. Also, I was on 2 convoy exercises where they replicate the conditions that they'll meet in a convoy, which means they'll come under attack. And that's what I saw.
And your sense was what, as far as going in to fight the war as it is now in Iraq? This is no longer a war about moving up from the south to get to Baghdad, is it?
Absolutely not. It's a guerrilla war. It's not a conventional war. And the group that I was with were people who have a high amount of skills in signals and communications. That is what their function is meant to be. But they do not have much or sometimes not any direct experience of being in combat.
And you describe a trainer who called these soldiers bullet magnets, which is the title of your piece. What does that mean?
Well, that's kind of a shocking term, but I think it's clear he thinks that these are people who are extremely vulnerable in the situation in which they might find themselves, especially in convoys, movement. The Pentagon is finding that soldiers are being attacked on the move and that the ones that are taking heaviest casualties are National Guard and reservists rather than combat troops.
These troops haven't been primarily trained for dealing with combat situations, let alone guerrilla war situations. They're signal corps, they're communications people, they're supply people. You observed a training exercise, in fact, in which if it had been real, everyone would have been dead.
Yeah, they're a soft target. They're not in a reinforcement. They're not in a bunker. And their reactions aren't as quick as they might be. They don't have the killer's instinct, the fighting instinct. On the training exercise, we sort of were 5 minutes out, barely that, of the, you know, from the start of the convoy, and we were finished. We were wiped out. And that was because the troops really didn't respond quickly enough, and they didn't identify the threat quickly enough. And, in fact, they would have been killed had this been for real.
We hear today of two more huge bombs in Iraq. Are soldiers, are these reservists, these National Guard, aware, acutely aware, you think, of the situation there and what they're going in to confront, and how do they feel about that?
Absolutely, and people will tell you openly that they're afraid and that they're scared. I mean, they can't not be. They also tell you that they're very grateful for the training they're receiving now. You know, the first group of reservists who went out a year ago did not have this training. So even this sort of rush intensive course they're having now is a lot better than what they got the first time out.
Do you worry about these guys? I know when you're with soldiers, you can often become kind of attached to them. A lot of them are great people.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to feel for them. I mean, they were sort of 19-year-old. I met a 19-year-old with a 3-month-old baby. I met parents who have 3 children, teenagers are at home, and these are kids who are asking questions, who are old enough to know that their mothers and fathers are risking their lives. There was a man there who's taking an 80% pay cut while he's with the reserves because he had to shut down his business. He has a quite successful business. He's self-employed. And that money is will be lost while he's off in Iraq.
So, I mean, some will say they signed on, and this is the reality of what happens and what you have to potentially face when you sign on.
Well, but most signed on in a climate when the reserves never went overseas. I mean, the unit that I was with, in its entire history, it's never been deployed in a time of war. So people sign on for a lot of different reasons. They sign on for college benefits. They sign on to give them their lives some structure after high school. They sign on for reasons of patriotism. But I don't think they fully realize that they were signing on for war. And indeed, until recently, they weren't.
Guardian reporter Suzanne Goldenberg was recently at Fort Bliss, Texas, where she witnessed how the military's training reservists and National Guard. Suzanne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, a full body goes for anywhere from $1,000 to $4,000, a foot $350. The U.S. cadaver trade. It's a big, unregulated business.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's here and now.
The doctor pulls on his surgical gloves, reaches inside the open body cavity, and fails to complete the difficult procedure. Oh, well, he'll try again after lunch and a dip in the hotel pool with his wife, because this doctor is on a training seminar sponsored by a medical equipment company, and the hotel ballroom holds a supply of human torsos for him to practice on. This is one fascinating and often disturbing facet of the cadaver trade. The largely legal, sometimes unethical, but unregulated buying and selling of body parts in the U.S. Annie Chaney is a New York writer. Her at times gruesome report in the March issue of Harper's Magazine is called The Resurrection Men, Scenes from the Cadaver Trade. And Annie's on the line. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I am a little upset after reading your article. It's somewhat upsetting. Your report opens with you at a medical seminar in Miami with several physicians in the ballroom practicing operations on cadavers.
That's right.
How does that happen?
Well, you're right. It is surprising. There's a lot of innovation happening right now in surgical equipment, and doctors need to learn how to use it. So as part of their continuing education, they'll go to these seminars, and often they're held in hotels. And they'll truck in some body parts, and the doctors will practice right there, either in a hotel room or in a banquet facility or wherever.
And there you go on to detail other ways that body parts are used and feeding this huge industry. Can you just tick off a few of the ways they're used?
Sure. They're used by surgical equipment companies like subsidiaries of Johnson & Johnson. They're used by researchers. They're used in these educational courses. They are also used for transplantation, which is sort of a separate thing, but they're processed into products. Bones, for example, will be ground up into a paste that's used in dental surgery.
Mm-hmm. Used by the Army in landmine experiments?
Right. The Army also uses bodies.
Well, but does anyone regulate the buying and selling of these cadavers?
Well, that's a very good question. In fact, that's how I stumbled onto this story. The FDA does regulate tissue that is used for transplantation. The United Network for Organ Sharing oversees organ donation. But nobody on the federal level regulates or oversees bodies that are used for scientific research and education. New York State is the only state that actually has a licensing procedure for tissue banks of this kind. So it's pretty much, open, just an open market, and pretty much anyone could get into it if they wanted to.
How easy is it to open up a tissue bank?
Well, you apply for a business license. You buy the equipment. Maybe you hire an anatomist who knows how to cut up a body. You get some freezers. Yeah, that's about as easy as it is.
And then the bodies?
The bodies, then you would, as this guy who owned the crematorium, Michael Brown, did, he had made up some consent forms that he copied from a university, and he advertised. One of the ways that people do it is they say, we'll give you a free cremation if you give us your body. And so it's a very attractive offer to families.
You introduced us to Augie Perna. Mm-hmm. Tell us about him.
He's a rather unusual character. He operates sort of as a middle person. And what he does is, if you're a surgical equipment company, you call him up and say, hi, we're doing a course in City X. It's going to be on urinary incontinence, for example. We want to teach doctors how to use this new device. Will you bring us 10 female torsos?
And where does he get them?
Well, he gets them from various sources, most of which are tissue banks, some of which in the past have been medical schools.
Say someone wants to buy it, how do you send it around the country?
Well, there are a couple of different ways. Some people use freight forwarders, which are companies that arrange. They're kind of brokers for transportation. They're also just sent directly through FedEx. In fact, I mentioned one incident recently. There were some packages that were leaking in a Missouri FedEx depot, and when they opened them, they found body parts, and these were unmarked.
What do you think people who donate their bodies after death, do you think they really have any idea how far they might travel?
No, I don't think people understand it, and I think it's important for them to be exercising really informed consent when they say they want to donate. So I think schools need to tell people, and tissue banks need to tell people what's going to happen later, because, otherwise, what's going to happen? People are going to eventually find out, and that sense of betrayal is really going to poison donation, and the numbers are really going to go down, I think.
How about you? Here you are drawn into this industry, and you find yourself standing there next to a lot of corpses and a lot of cases. What was that like for you?
I found it fascinating. It captivates you, I think, partly because it's such a mystery. There's very little known about this business.
You write that you had olfactory hallucinations?
Yeah, I don't know if this is a documented phenomenon. I think probably what it is, if you spend time around the body parts, they do smell, although the people in the business work very hard to eliminate a lot of that smell. But it almost gets in your nose hairs, That's how it was explained to me, anyway. And it just kind of stays there. And so for days afterwards, this smell would just come upon me, and it was really disturbing.
Mm. Annie, before we let you go, the strangest thing you saw?
I think the strangest thing that I saw were the torsos of people in igloo coolers, the same kind of cooler you might take to a Super Bowl. Two torsos smashed into an igloo cooler. That was very surprising.
Yeah.
And in a hotel.
Right. Well, Annie, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Annie Chaney is a writer living in New York City. Her report, which appears in the March issue of Harper's Magazine, is called The Resurrection Men, Scenes from the Cadaver Trade.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, incredible heat, starvation, hallucinations, disease. Long before the Panama Canal, the true story of an American's expedition to try to link the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A new plan from the Homeland Security Department to send American security officials to European and Asian airports could exacerbate tensions between the U.S. and foreign governments. The initiative was developed by U.S. Customs and would be aimed at identifying and apprehending terrorists before they board U.S.-bound planes. Eric Lischblau is covering the story for The New York Times. He joins us from Washington. Eric, first of all, tell us a little bit more about how this plan would work.
Well, the idea would be to have probably 6 or 7 U.S. inspectors go to major hub airports, places like London, France, Tokyo, Frankfurt, Mexico City, only with the agreement of the foreign governments, and that's what's now being negotiated, and do a sort of more rigorous hands-on job of looking for fraudulent documents, fake visas, and things like that, and possibly catching terrorists in that way.
This in light of recent stories of several flights to the U.S. being stopped because of concern about who was on board.
Yeah, the plan was under discussion even before all that, but this is certainly seen as a way of avoiding the type of widespread flight cancellations that we had in December and January. This is seen as a way of screening the passengers on the ground before it reaches the point of having to cancel the flight at the gate.
Right, because we understand that the airlines are fined $10,000 if they miss someone at their security in Europe who ends up here.
Right.
Well, some would say that European airlines might be interested in that help, but the head of the Association of European Airlines expressed concern that the plan was not discussed between governments before being released. Explain their irritation.
Yeah, I think there'll be a mixed reaction in Europe and elsewhere. I think there will be some countries and airlines that will welcome U.S. law enforcement support. They'll say that, you know, U.S. has some of the best training and best people in the world and bring them on. But I think there will also be some people who will see this as perhaps another instance of U.S. bigfooting and of trying to assert its control over areas that it hasn't traditionally been involved in.
Is there precedence for it? Has the U.S. done this anywhere else?
Yeah, you know, there actually was a pilot program that what was then the INS did in 2002 for about 5 months, and they caught about 2,800 people who were trying to board flights with fraudulent documents and the like. And so there reviving that in a way, sort of fine-tuning it to be more catered to terrorism concerns. Mm.
There's also been controversy recently because the U.S. government has asked certain European flights to have armed American marshals on the flights, and some have refused. How does this relate to that issue?
Well, I think it's certainly part of that whole discussion of the U.S. trying very aggressively to safeguard its own borders and meeting with resistance. There've been concerns from Spain, from British Pilots Union, around the globe, really, from airlines and nations saying we are not comfortable with the idea of the U.S. saying we need armed marshals in certain flights. And in some cases, they've simply refused to go along, and the U.S. said, well, you're not crossing into U.S. airspace.
Yeah, and this might actually be a possible alternative to demanding sky marshals.
Right. I think the U.S. sees this as a way of avoiding that kind of 11th-hour confrontation.
Is there a timeline for the U.S. plan?
My understanding is that they hope to get this underway at a few major airports by summer. They're looking possibly at starting in Amsterdam and one or two other places.
Eric, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Lischblau reports for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
Type the innocent word toys into an online search engine, and you won't just find items for children. You'll find links to sex toys and other websites, including pornography, that parents might not want their children to see. In 1998, Congress passed the Child Online Protection Act to block children's access to sexually explicit sites. But the law has never gone into effect because courts have repeatedly ruled that the rights of adults to access those sites would be harmed. So today, the issue is once again before the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us on the line is Professor Robert Shapiro, who teaches constitutional law at Emory University in Atlanta. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Professor, the case before the High Court today is John Ashcroft versus the American Civil Liberties Union. What are both sides arguing?
Well, when the United States is defending the statute, is saying there needs to be some way to protect children from all the kinds of obscene and indecent material that exists on the Internet. It's very easy for a child to happen on by accident and to some quite improper material, or a child might happen onto it not so accidentally. On the other side, the ACLU is saying that under our free speech protections given by the First Amendment, the government can't prohibit adults from accessing material on the theory that it could be harmful to children. And here, the safeguard is to try to keep children from getting at the improper material could also make it difficult for the adults to get the material.
Well, Professor, as we said in the introduction, in 1998, Congress passed the Child Online Protection Act. What did that do?
The Child Online Protection Act made it illegal to distribute over the Internet material that would be indecent for children. As a defense to that, the Act says that if you have some kind of screening mechanism, such as requiring an age verification or a credit card, that you can't be held liable. The problem is that a lot of adults don't like to provide information about themselves to obtain access to material. And so there are a number of people who provide content about sexual-oriented material, safe sex information, matters of that nature that are concerned that if they're required to screen out people from obtaining access to their websites, nobody's going to come.
At the bottom of it all, if you're a parent concerned about your child's access to online porn, even objectively speaking, the Online Protection Act hasn't worked very well because children can still get access to it, right?
That's right. I think that's another argument that is going to be made about why the statute is unconstitutional. Congress tried a very similar scheme in the Communications Decency Act in 1996, and the United States Supreme Court said that act was unconstitutional. And one of the consistent problems seems to be that statutes like this just aren't that effective. For example, there are international sites these days that provide a lot of pornographic material, and unfortunately, the laws of the United States really can do nothing at all about these overseas providers.
The bottom line is somebody has to do filtering to keep kids from seeing stuff their parents may not want them to see, right?
Exactly. That really is what's at stake here. The people who are attacking the constitutionality of the statute say that this filtering should be done, but it really should be done by parents. and that there are a number of commercially available filters that would achieve a very similar result without restricting the access of other adults to the material.
Which way do you think the court's going to go?
Well, this court is very protective of free speech, and I think that this statute is very similar to the statute that the United States Supreme Court previously held unconstitutional. So I think there's a good chance the Supreme Court will hold this statute unconstitutional.
Robert Shapiro is professor of law at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Professor, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Still to come, old songs from the South get a remix.
You're listening to Here and Now.
NASA scientists are expected to make an historic announcement today of findings from the Mars rover Opportunity. The NASA press conference is scheduled for 2 p.m. Eastern Time, but advanced speculation is that the agency will say that Mars was once a lush, water-rich world. And might they also say something about the possibility of biology, life, on Mars? Anthony Dynan Cabrera is the managing editor of Space.com. And Anthony, what are you hearing about today's announcement?
I think we're hearing what everyone else is hearing, that the Mars Opportunity rover has fulfilled its mandate. And its mandate was to search for signs that water may have existed on Mars at one point in time, but leaves open the possibility that water may also exist now in some liquid form.
Well, because didn't we already know that there is some water on Mars, at least in the polar ice caps?
Yes, we know that there's water ice, and we know that there's carbon dioxide ice that's known commonly as dry ice on Mars. The spacecraft Mars Odyssey, as well as Mars Express, has proven that. But what we're looking for is liquid water. And then they believe they have that there now. They believe that there's some kind of brine, there's some kind of liquid form that's causing the sand and the soil on the planet to stick together and clump.
And we've been able to look at photographs sent back from Opportunity on the NASA website, and some people think they're seeing something in those photographs.
People are seeing, there's a photograph that's running out there that we jokingly have been referred to as the Rotini. There's a spiral-like object embedded in the soil, in the sand, in one of the rock structures. And it's causing people to think, well, what is that? Is it a natural form of the soil that was formed over years of erosion and sedimentary rock and whatnot? Or is it something that was left behind a long time ago when water may have been more common in that area? And what if that thing that was left behind was of a biological nature? That is the question. Is there something of biological formation on the planet, or was there in the past?
Do you expect that they'll make any kind of reference to that today?
Not too sure. I think the possibility is they're going to do an emphasis on the mandate of the Mars rover mission, that is water. You know, was there water ever there? And again, a lot of this stuff is still speculation, but there are a lot of rumors out there in the scientific world that's kind of saying, well, there's something that leans towards biology.
How exciting is this?
It is amazing. It is very exciting. We've come to the point, I think there's a kind of like, water on Mars. No, that's an amazing discovery. If it's true that they have found, you know, significant facts to say that there was, or to a certain extent, there is this liquid water on Mars, I mean, that's a huge stepping stone. It basically changes the way we look at life on Earth, as well as life in our solar system, and then maybe moving forward, life and how life forms and how planets evolve in our galaxy and in the universe. I mean, it's basically one of those stepping stones to say, wow, there's something else, that it wasn't only here on Earth.
Well, Anthony, if there was this large amount of water on Mars, where did it go?
That's the next step of questions. Why didn't mass quantities of water stay around? There are not lush or even, you know, shallow pools on the planet. I mean, those are the next series of questions that need to be asked, is why did Mars, for lack of a better phrase, fail, whereas Earth didn't?
Well, Anthony, we await the press conference. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Anthony Dignan Cabrera is managing editor of Space.com. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Stay tuned. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Most of us probably associate the remix with dance cuts featuring sampled classic pop songs, like a riff lifted from some James Brown funk masterpiece. But the remix takes on a whole new sound with the debut release of the New Orleans-based group Tangle Eye. The CD's called Alan Lomax's Southern Journey Remixed. Who's Alan Lomax? Well, he's one of the greatest, probably the greatest, archivists of American roots music. Mostly in the Deep South in the 1940s and 50s, Lomax recorded everything from legends like Lead Belly to anonymous work songs sung by prisoners on a penal farm. And that's what Tangle Eye's remixed, old music with an entirely new spin. Tangle Eye's Scott Billington and Steve Reynolds have produced or engineered hundreds of albums between them. Scott joins us in the studio. Hi, Scott.
How you doing, Bill?
Steve joins us from New Orleans. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Well, first of all, guys, I just want to give our listeners first a sample of what you started with. This is an original Alan Lomax recording. Here's CB88 Cook singing Whoa, Buck at Mississippi State Penitentiary in 1947.
Ask that gal to marry me, boys, what you reckon she said? CB, I would not have you if all the rest was dead. Boys, you know that I'm in bad shape tonight. I'm telling you, me and that gal sure gotta have a fight. Ooh, Lord, hey, 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 hey.
Well, now let's hear what Steve Reynolds and Scott Billington of Tangle Eye did with that recording.
Ask that girl to marry me, boy. What the heck she said. Stevie, I would not have you if all the rest was dead. Boy, you know that I'm in bad shape tonight. I'm telling you, me and that gal sure gotta have a fight.
Wow. Scott, where did you get the idea?
Well, quite a few years ago in the early 1990s, Steve and I made quite a few Zydeco records, the South Louisiana French African-American music. There was also a dance hall scene in Houston that was catching fire at the time, and we decided we'd try to take some of the Zydeco music and make remixes for the Houston dance halls. So that's how we got into remixing more tradition-oriented music. When we started thinking about a bigger project that we could take on and dreaming about what we might like to work with if we had the opportunity, the Alan Lomax recordings, That was it. That was the dream we had.
Were you concerned at all, Steve, about losing some of the power of this original stuff? Maybe, you know, were you concerned at all about maybe making it seem frivolous by putting a dance beat on top of it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're really careful to be sure that we retained as much of the power in the original performance from all the vocals as we could. And that's what kind of dictated the arrangement that we put it in.
Who played on some of these tracks?
On the track we just heard, the holler, Whoa Buck, that was the New Orleans acoustic bassist James Singleton. But we had people like the young blues player Corey Harris,
mm-hmm.
Jeff Rains, who's the guitar player with the jam band Galactic, Henry Butler, who's a wonderful New Orleans piano player, Devel Crawford, who's a young church organist in New Orleans.
Let's hear another cut from the album, John Henry's Blues. What sample did you use here?
This was a prisoner who was chopping a tree as he sang, a guy named Ed Lewis. You can still hear the axe hits in there.
John Henry, he says a man ain't nothing but a man. Oh, I would die
Scott, let's hear Hangman's Tree. Tell me a little about it first.
Oh, this was a solo ballad sung by an Appalachian singer called Almeda Riddle. It goes way back, I think, to England, and I think it's in the Book of Child Ballads, which is a famous old book of ethnomusicology. I guess when I heard that song and started thinking about what we might do with it, for some reason I heard the harmony to Charles Mingus's Goodbye Pork Pie Hat. It's got that in there.
You got all this music in your head.
And then, Steve and I, before we started work on this, we made a catalog of all of the recordings that we wanted to work with. We wrote down the number of beats per minute for each track or the rhythm and the key that it was in. And we noticed that there was a Mississippi Fife and Drum Band sample that was in the same key and at the same tempo.
It's not about just slapping one thing on top of another.
No, it's not. It's really looking for the right pieces to use. In the chorus of the song, it was almost a magical thing that happened. There's a little fife melody in a minor key that seems like it must have been played in the room at the same time as Almeda Riddle singing the line on the gallows tree, if you listen to that. And it was interesting to see things like that come together suddenly when we weren't expecting them sometimes.
Or did you come to see your brother?
There must be some enduring depth in this music for it to be still so vibrant that you can put a 21st century rhythm on it and create something new.
Yeah, that's listening to it. The soulfulness and just general raw primal urge of expression was so strong on that that really spoke to us in terms of creating new music around it.
Yeah, I guess you could say a lot of dance music, if it can be accused of anything, would be that it's got a certain coldness to it, right, Scott? But the sort of the heat that comes off
sure.
These very old recordings is amazing.
Well, it's interesting listening to these voices because it's clearly another era. These are pre-American Idol voices.
Yeah.
you get the feeling that they're singing about who they really are.
Yeah.
And it's easy to romanticize that notion, I think, but you can feel something when you listen to these voices.
To some extent, maybe it will drive some people back to the original recordings, too.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope it makes people curious to want to hear them. It's interesting that something, in the digital age, that you can take a painting or a sound and manipulate it to bring it to people in a new way. I think Steve and I were a little uneasy about that or just about that kind of concept. It's like putting a beautiful old stone in a new setting and bring them forward so that people can hear them again, sort of amplify them in a new way. Maybe it will lead people back to those old voices.
I want to thank you both for joining us. Scott Billington and Steve Reynolds are Tangalai. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Bill.
Tangalai's debut album is called Alan Lomax's Southern Journey. Next.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.